Sure, it's kind of batshit. It's like, how do you talk about it?
What, it's two people talking about at the kitchen table about a story that one knows and one doesn't. It's like, what? This is like, I mean, the story is so great that, but I think it is like one of those stories that may be undiscussable. Like, it just needs to be read. That said, here we are.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. The Ice Wagon Going Down the Street is one of Mavis Gallant's most beloved stories. Peter Fraser is a Canadian married to a British wife, Sheila. On a Sunday morning in Toronto, they lounge around in Peter's sister's kitchen, where they've lived for 17 weeks with their two children. They've traveled in Europe, and they've lived in Paris and Geneva, and they've even lived in Ceylon. Peter held some low-level jobs in that time, including as a filing clerk in an office in Geneva. Just a few mere lines into the story, Peter thinks about Agnes Bruzen. We later learn she was a co-worker in that office in Geneva. She's described as a mole-faced, round-shouldered young woman. She's inexperienced at life, from a large family where she was the oldest of many children. As you'll hear, Agnes has a misstep. She gets drunk at a party. Peter's wife and the party hostess urge Peter to see the girl home. What occurs then is as mysterious and intimate as almost anything else we would find in a love story. It's odd and unlikely, but it's honest. It is perhaps the most honest exchange Peter has had with another person. But so much time has passed by the time we see Peter and Sheila just sitting around on that early Sunday morning. What's on Peter's mind in quiet moments there? Agnes. But why? There was nothing between them, no kisses or words of love. They didn't sleep together. What did happen is that in that moment of drunkenness, Agnes tells Peter a simple story from her childhood. It's a story of longing for something ineffable and unnameable. And perhaps Peter felt this yearning too, even if he didn't recognize it as such. And all that remains instead is remembering Agnes. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Ice Wagon Going Down the Street by Mavis Gallant. What is the story then? It's undiscussable and it's hard to say what it's about. Isn't it hard to say what it's about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a story about things that happened, things that didn't happen, things that might have happened, and now that time has passed. Something like that.
Yes, yeah, so we have two characters, Peter and Sheila.
Yes.
I think, okay, so every reading is a completely different reading with the story for me.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure why. I was reading a lot of Gallant lately, a lot, maybe too much. So the stories are very sad for me for some reason this round. And I was trying to figure out why this particular story. So I'm trying to figure that out. And then I read something where whoever, some blogger was saying, it's not sad at all. And just accept it and read it for that. I think where I'm finding the sadness is in how, I don't know if this is the right way to describe it, how out of touch everybody is about what's really going on, how sort of in denial everybody is about their own lives. And yet that is what elements their life, that is their life. And a lot of people live their lives that way, I think.
I mean, everybody does. I certainly do. It's a good question. Is the story sad or not? I mean, it is and it isn't. I hate to agree with the blogger. Whatever the water is, but there's a certain buoyancy in it, and sure, you know, Peter and Sheila are more I don't know, privilege sounds like the wrong word, but you know, are more I don't know, they got each other. They don't know much, but they got more than Agnes, and I think that's what it comes down to. There's a moment in the party scene where Peter thinks to himself that he'd be just like Agnes if it wasn't for Sheila, you know. And there's something about this story being about a couple and how they live together and not together and together that makes the story, I think, ultimately joyful, if not also kind of cruel.
So he's Canadian and she's from a poor family, an English family.
Sheila. Right.
And you're right. It's sort of like they move through this world with, you know, surviving. It's sort of like they're this team and they bring out the Balenciaga dress and they have like this very cocooned existence with each other that doesn't even really include their daughters.
I loved about this story that the kids are completely independent entities, which kids are, right? I mean, I think we should set it up a little bit and say that you have a Canadian couple, or he's Canadian, she's British from a poorer family, and they meet in London, but they're expatriates. They live in Paris and they live in Geneva and they go all over the place, including to the Far East. And then they end up washed up back in Ontario at the beginning of the story. And they're sitting at the kitchen table on a Sunday. The kids have gone to church with the aunt and they're reminiscing about this life that they had out on the road. You know, for me, it's pretty, they're kind of reliving the excitement, mm-hmm. But then the story turns in a way that, you know, you could never expect in a million years, what Gallant pulls on us, which is that the thing that Peter remembers is something Sheila didn't even know about and wasn't even anything, which was a kind of connection that Peter makes with this woman, Agnes, who works next to him when he's not working at his job that he doesn't have to do in Geneva.
Okay, so but the thing is, they end up where they end up. They're staying with his sister. They're going on 17 weeks of this.
Yes, it's a long time.
I don't know if he self-sabotaged, you know, his place in his social circle by this weird thing that he did of lying on the floor. Do you know that part where he's lying on the floor?
Yeah, at the wedding.
Yes, at the wedding.
And it's completely inexplicable and wonderful. You know, these are people who just kind of, they follow their whims. You know, it's the 50s. They're just kind of floating around.
Yeah. Well,
on being kind of wealthy and privileged, even though they're not that wealthy.
Right. So after 4 months, they were moved away from Paris because of this incident at the Trudeau wedding at the Ritz, where he he lies down on the floor with his brass pot on his chest and he's singing. It's very strange. It makes everybody uncomfortable. They end up in Geneva with this job, right, where he's filing pictures in the information service of an international agency. And okay, then there's this line that I underlined this time. Peter's wife had loved him in Paris. Whatever she wanted in marriage, she found that winter there. That's very specific. In Geneva, where Peter was file clerk and they lived in a furnished flat, she pretended they were in Paris and life was still the same. You know, and they would bring out that black designer dress. And, you know, even if they were just having an ordinary meal together. I don't know. I feel I think couples do this. They are in on each other's whims. They are in on each other's way of being and they just allow it to they allow things to persist. And, you know, I think that just spares everybody a lot of trouble. He knows what she's about. She does not want to be rat poor. You know, she has aspirations to be wealthy and at fancy parties and on the first list and all of this, the first list of the Burleys. And, you know, and he's just somebody I feel like he's very different from her, even though they make a great couple together and they're in on each other's deal. I feel like her aspirations are really defined and his are less so. But it's almost like he has no other place to go and no other way to be until he meets Agnes, I think. And Agnes is the person he's recalling secretly, you know, had this situation with that's still a secret from Sheila.
I mostly agree with you. I absolutely agree with you that that Agnes is where Peter gets some small, if minuscule, sense of purpose in his life. It's the strangest love story, I'm just going to say it, that I know of. The oddest one. Maybe with a competition from First Love by Eudora Welty. This is just a beautifully odd love story. That's how I see it. But I also see Sheila, like a lot of gallant characters, I don't think she can be summed up very easily. I think she's actually, there's something about her that almost, I think she kind of sees in Peter that he has this need to connect with Agnes. And she actually sends him out to go find her after the party. You know, what ends up happening is that they all end up at a party together. And Agnes is this hilariously presented fellow Canadian who's put in the same office as Peter because she's Canadian, as if that was somehow like, they're kind of like, it's like a zoo when they put the two Canadians together. You know, and she's got her Kleenex box on her desk and her Bible, and she's very prim and proper, and she's actually doing the job. Peter does not ever do the job. He reads the newspaper. You know, they're completely missing the boat on each other. And then there's this party and everyone's drunk, including Agnes. It's a hot costume party that only the most lame people show up in costumes, including Agnes, and she's totally humiliated. And she goes out into the, you know, out into the snowy night drunk, and the host and Sheila tell Peter to go get her, make sure she gets home.
Okay. Can we take a pause here?
Yeah.
When they're driving to the party, when Peter and Sheila are driving to the party, Peter says, "This is the first snow." "I can see that," said Sheila. "Hurry, darling, my hair." Then he says, "It's the first snow." "You're repeating yourself," she said. "Please hurry. Think of my poor shoes, my hair." She was born in an ugly city, and so was Peter. But they have this difference. She does not know the importance of the first snow, the first clean thing in a dirty year. Yeah. Then there's that. And then, I'm sorry, but this whole deal with the costumes and the way Agnes is dressed, I'm trying to find that description of her. "He was granted the sight of her drowning face. She had dressed with comic intention, obviously with care. And now she was a ragged hobo, half tramp, half clown. Her hair was tucked up under a bowler hat. The six costumed guests who had made the same mistake, the ghost, the gypsy, the Athenian maid, the geisha, the Martian, and the Apache, were delighted to find a seventh. But Agnes was not amused. She was gasping for life." So she's not having a good time in her costume and then proceeds to get really drunk. Anyway, I just wanted to point to the thing about the snow and then, you know, enter Agnes in this party situation where she's wearing this getup and she gets drunk. And then, yes, she's having such a hard time of things that Sheila says to Peter, go help her. And then what happens?
I want to make one general observation about Gallant, that I think she understands how ridiculous and comic the lives of her people are. And yet there's still like, there's always a point where it becomes not ridiculous. I think that's where the title comes from. I think that's where the line that you say about the snow comes from, even though it's funny. She's like, "My hair. Oh, let's not, I don't want to talk about the snow." And he's like, but she doesn't realize this thing that about the snow being the first clean thing of the year in a dirty city. It says a lot about a person that observes that. At base, her work is comic in the same way, you know, not to throw around Chekhov like we do, but in the same way, you know, that he saw the world as dark and, or sad and comic, not dark and comic, sad and comic. That's where I think you're getting the sorrow from, because it's absolutely there, but it's part of the comedy. And what ends up happening is this, in anybody else's story, Peter would have taken Agnes home and maybe they would have slept together in a drunken stupor ecstasy ridiculousness. Instead, they don't. And Agnes keeps saying over and over again that, you know, that she, her life is turning out differently than she thought. Her parents had these high expectations for her. And then the scene in the room just kind of peters out. And then Peter walks out into the snow. It's over. even though they worked together for a few more weeks. And there's something there that happened between them that is more complicated than it would have been had they slept together, I think.
Yes. I think the not happening is the happening. If it had happened, we might not have the story at all. I mean, it would not be a story.
No, I don't think he'd be remembering it after 17 weeks at the sister's house in Ontario.
But there's so much here that Gallant manages with this character. I mean, yes, we see, I mean, she's rather obnoxious in some ways. She's young, and the way she sort of equips her office space, and he's, you know, sitting there reading the paper, and she puts her certificate up on the wall. But then we learn this backstory from her about her too. To me, that's where some of this sorrow is, some of this longing is to know where she's come from, what the expectations are from her family on her, where she ends up, you know, where she's stuck with this office mate. And I, you know, I'm trying to figure out as I'm rereading, like, what does she want? Like, you know, it's hard to know what he really wants besides, I mean, I can't even really put my finger on what Peter wants. I find Sheila, because of her own being rat poor, I mean, I feel like she wants to have a good time. She wants beautiful things. She wants nice things. She wants to be a party girl. She wants an easy life. She wants parties. She doesn't want her kids. You know, she wants an easy life. And
I think you're hard on Sheila. I just feel like, she, you know, she's not weighted down by...
She's complex too, but in a very different way that I also kind of understand, you know, with everything that Gallant gives us. It's like, I feel like with Agnes, she's in a new context, you know, this Norwegian that ends up in Canada, that ends up here. And, she's just following this handbook for what she's supposed to be doing, ends up at this party. But there's this whole thing with the snow there too. And as they're walking to her place, she gets sick, and she keeps insisting that she never drinks and that she's not used to it. But there is this section where he passed his own handkerchief over her wet, weeping face, upturned like the face of one of his little girls. And earlier, who does he compare to his sister? There was something similar with something with the sister and the wife. He looks at his sister admiringly, as he has often looked at his wife. And then over here, the upturn, like the face of one of his little girls. Anyway, I don't know if that means anything.
Because Peter's pathetic. I mean, Peter can't get through life without his sister getting him a job and his wife getting him through the day. He has a bit of imagination, and his imagination is somehow attracted to Agnes. And the reason I give Sheila a few props anyway, is that she's the one who recognizes this. After the party, when she's actually out with this rich guy and comes home late and he's all jealous, she comes in blithely without any kind of discussion about where she's been. And she says, she takes one look at him and she says, "Poor old Pete, are you in love with Agnes?" She's the one who knows it. She's the only one in the story that knows it. Not Agnes, not Peter, nobody. It's her. And I feel like there's something about this relationship that is again, destructive to other people. It kind of makes me think, for some reason, I don't really know why, but the way the Clintons move through their lives, you know, destroying everybody in their path but each other. I mean, if they were more accomplished, they might be the Clintons. But these are people who, you know, who do leave some wreckage.
I think Sheila wanted him to go get Agnes to get rid of him, so she could carry on at the party the way she was doing. I don't know.
Maybe, but then she's setting them up to go to Ceylon.
Also, but I will say this: this next part where she says she's not used to drinking, the trust in her tilted face had perplexed him. He wanted to get back to Sheila and have her explain something.
Yeah.
He had forgotten what it was, but Sheila would know. There's this reliance that he has on his father, on his sister. on Sheila for a different reason. And then with Agnes, he's the one that's got to step up and be the one that the other person is leaning on. And he does not have a clue what to do, except that he does kind of see him. I don't want to be corny about it, but not see himself in it, but connect with her on some kind of meaningful way. It's not love. It's just for once, he's the guy that's got to step up and, you know, do something to help somebody. And it says, do you live around here? As he spoke, she let herself fall. He had wiped her face and now she trusted him to pick her up, set her on her feet, take her wherever she ought to be. He pulled her up and she stood wordless, humble, as he brushed the snow from her from her tramp's clothes. Snow horizontally crossed the lamplight. The street was silent. Agnes had lost her hat. Snow, which he tasted, melted on her hands. His gesture of licking snow from her hands was formal as a handshake. He tasted snow on her hands, and then they walked on. What does that mean?
I mean, right? It's the heart of the story, and it's completely beautiful and baffling. He licks snow off her hands. It's great. It's this drunken, I don't know. And I love it. When you read, I actually thought the "what does that mean" was actually in the text until I just looked and it's not, because it would have been a perfectly in place. But I think they have that, and they have the ice wagon coming down the street. And that is the thing that Agnes tells him. His only triumph in this story, and maybe in life, is that he sat there and listened to Agnes tell a story. And if Peter's done one thing, it might be that. And that's what the Mavis Gallant realizes, that, oh, that's the story of this guy's life, that he was just the recipient of a story from somebody who needed to tell it. I don't know. For me, why I knew this story was going to be impossible to discuss, because anyone listening to this is going to be like, what the fuck are they talking about? Literally, what are we talking about?
Well, we know he licked the glasses at the party when he was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That was something else. But
we know everything about this guy. That's the amazing thing. The story, you know, we know these people. All three of them are getting through the world somehow.
When they have this, I'll just call it intimate. I don't know. It's close.
Yeah.
And she says again, I never drink. And the next thing she does, as you say, is she tells him this story. In our house, we didn't smoke or drink. My mother was ambitious for me more than for Harry and the others. I've never been alone before. When I was a kid, I would get up in the summer before the others and I'd see the ice wagon going down the street. I'm alone now. Mrs. Burley's found me an apartment. It's only one room. She likes it because it's in the old part of town. I don't like old houses. Old houses are dirty. You don't know who was there before. She's telling him so much. And then he says, I should have a car somewhere. I'm not sure where we are. And he's, you know, he's still all about helping her, and he's not terribly immersed in what she's saying. But she's saying it, and he remembers it later. And it's such a... People are so complicated, you know. I also like the part where they pay the driver twice. Like, that's so.
And then they pat themselves on the back for being North Americans, yeah. As opposed to the Europeans who are so cheap on tips, which we know is true. I think if the story is about anything, it's about the things that happen to us that we think are insignificant. The people that we think we're not going to remember end up being like everything. You know, I think of my grandmother when she was dying and delirious in the hospital, and for some reason she was fixated on her dentist's son. For some reason, who knows what was looping in her head about the dentist's son. Like, she finally, my mom kind of finally figured out, like, she's talking about her dentist's son. What? You know, and it seems like Agnes would not be the story of someone's life. But I think the argument here, if she's making an argument at all, is that this is definitely one of a handful of stories about Peter that matter. I mean, sentence for sentence, and we can't even go into it. There's a million of them. Yeah. Sheila, her shoes were stained and snow had softened her lacquered hair. She was not wasted. She was the most beautiful woman there. So many things echo other parts of the story, because there's this hilarious line also using the word wasted when they invite Agnes over, because they can't figure out why Agnes is getting invited to the Burleys party and not them. Mm-hmm. And so they want to have Agnes over to check it out. Sheila does anyway. And Sheila's performing as she does and pretending to be this, you know, old heiress, you know, or some kind of heiress, you know, and shutting her mouth and, I mean, shutting her eyes and putting her head back and waiting for Peter to bring her a cigarette. And he says to himself, like, she's wasting her performance on Agnes, who doesn't give a damn. Agnes is this mousy woman. Well, she's actually described a lot of times in the story as a mole looking, which is not the most flattering description. But, you know, Gallant never shies away from the cruelties that other people think about each other. I don't think that Gallant herself is cruel towards her characters, but she knows damn well we are cruel to each other. And she's not going to lie about that, yes. You know, ever. This woman, Agnes, ends up being, because she looks at Peter. She looks at him and he feels looked at. And maybe Sheila doesn't look at him that way because, you know, Sheila knows what she sees. Maybe Agnes is seeing something else. And that's, it gives him some kind of something. And then she tells him this story about how when she was a kid, she used to wake up really, really early and be alone so she could hear the ice wagon coming down the street, which it was summer, and the ice wagon delivered ice to people in the summer in Saskatchewan. You know, and that's just this gorgeous idea of like waking up in a summer day in some little town in Saskatchewan and waiting for the sound of that truck, the wagon with the ice. And that's the gift she gives him. And that's what he remembers. And he's always going to remember the ice wagon going down the street. And I read the story today and I had totally forgotten where the ice wagon, the role of the ice wagon in the story, I completely had forgotten completely. And so she's given me the gift again. You know I love this story. I know I love this story. I knew I loved the story until today, but if you asked me what the hell it was about, I would have said it was about a couple. I completely forgot Agnes. Which is crazy, because Agnes is the story.
At the beginning, when they're sitting in the kitchen drinking their coffee and thinking about the past, they say the names of people as if they were magic, and Peter thinks, Agnes Bruson. But there are hundreds of other names. Then the very next thing is about this, the private married joke that Peter and Sheila wear these silk dressing gowns that they bought in Hong Kong. But then at the end of the story, near the end, Sheila and Peter talk about those times they take on the glamour of something still to come. It is then he remembers Agnes Bruson. It's the same moment that was described at the beginning of the story.
Mm-hmm.
He never says her name. Sheila wouldn't remember Agnes. Agnes is the only secret Peter has from his wife. The only puzzle he pieces together without her help. Peter wonders what they were doing over there in Geneva, not Sheila and Peter, Agnes and Peter. It is almost as if they had once run away together, silly as children, irresponsible as lovers. Something has happened, and he's recalling her. He's recalling Agnes. While they were out in world affairs, picking up microbes and debts, always on the fringe of disaster, the fringe of a fortune, Agnes went on and did what? They lost each other. He thinks of the ice wagon going down the street. He sees something he has never seen in his life, a western town that belongs to Agnes. Here is Agnes, small, mole-faced, round-shouldered because she has always carried a younger child. She watches the ice wagon and the trail of ice water in a morning invented for her, hers. He sees the weak prairie trees and the shadows on the sidewalk. Nothing moves except the shadows and the ice wagon and the changing amber of the child's eyes. The child is Peter. He has seen the grain of the cement sidewalk and the grass in the cracks and the dust and the dandelions at the edge of the road. He is there. That's my favorite line. He has seen the grain of the cement sidewalk and the grass in the cracks and the dust and the dandelions at the edge of the road. He is there.
It doesn't get any better in terms of how a great story writer turns a story, in the sense that it's what Agnes granted to him is this vision. This is a guy who's been a lot of places, but he's never been west in his own country. He's never gone to Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, and this was years ago that this happened. Years ago, some office mate of his told him a story. And that story provides him with a vision. It's bizarre that, again, that the weight of someone's life, you know, at least in this story, in the way, you know, these characters don't exist in any other place other than in this story. And where Peter's life lands is on Agnes's story, from Agnes's eyes. So that's why I think it's, you know, absolutely a love story. And this is what they exchanged, you know, instead of, you know, bodily fluids, they exchanged this story and he accepted it. And there's something, it goes beyond sorrow. It goes beyond the comedy. It's something, you know, something, some substance in his life. This is it. But that doesn't mean his relationship with his wife is nothing. It's all like, you know, subtle shades. She's making no political point here. You know what I mean? Except that people exist and that Agnes exists. And I think that that is a thundering political point, because most people at that party or most people in that office, and definitely Sheila herself, has no idea that Agnes existed, even though they've met and lived among her.
But that next part, he has taken the morning that belongs to Agnes. He is up before the others and he knows everything. There is nothing he doesn't know. He could keep the morning if he wanted to, but what can Peter do with the start of a summer day? Sheila is here. It is a true Sunday morning with its dimness and headache and remorse and regrets. And this is life. He says, "We have the Balenciaga." He touches Sheila's hand. The children have their aunt now, and he and Sheila have each other. Everything works out somehow or other. Let Agnes have the start of the day. Let Agnes think it was invented for her, who wants to be alone in the universe. No, begin at the beginning. Peter lost Agnes. Agnes says to herself somewhere, "Peter is lost."
And that's wonderful that she gives Agnes the last word, imagining that Agnes is somewhere out there thinking, remember that shallow guy I shared an office with who didn't do any work and read the paper with his feet up?
Hey, you still with us, still listening? Well, here's a little bit of a bonus clip with Peter Orner reading from Mavis Gallant's The Ice Wagon Going Down the Street.
And they're talking about the night before in the office. "I behaved in a silly way I had no right to. I led you to think I might do something wrong. I might have tried something," he said gallantly, "but that would have been my fault and not yours." She put her knuckle in her mouth, and he could scarcely hear. "It was because of you. I was afraid you might be blamed, or else you blame yourself." "There's no question of any blame," he said. "Nothing happened. We both had a lot to drink. Forget it. Nothing happened. You'd remember if it had." She put down her hand. There was an expression on her face. Now she sees me, he thought. She had never looked at him after the first day. And then this parenthetical, it will not convey over the radio. "He has since tried to put a name to the look on her face. But how can he now, after so many voyages? after Ceylon and Hong Kong, and she was nearly leaving him and all their difficulties, the money owed, the rows with hotel managers, the lost and found steamer trunk, the children throwing up the foreign food. The parentheses end. All of that is their life since this has happened. In a parenthesis, in parentheses, it's like Mrs. Ramsey dying in brackets in Into the Lighthouse, and then the next sentence is back to the moment in the office. She sees me now, he thought. What does she see? And that's when she starts to talk, and he starts to listen. And again, this is why I think, like, if you compare the years in Ceylon and Hong Kong and Sheila almost leaving him and all their difficulties with money and the rows with hotel managers, all that's one line. But Agnes, this insignificant person in their lives, gets all this airtime because somehow she's meant more than everything that's happened to him since. And that is a mystery. It's just a mystery. And that's why I think it's a love story. In some ways, I feel like trying to talk about it wrecks it, but, you know, it is what it is.
Why does it wreck it?
Because it's like, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, Gallant says herself in the intro, she's like, there's something I keep wanting to say about reading short stories. I'm doing it now because I may never have another occasion. Stories are not chapters of novels. They should not be read one after another as if they were meant to follow along. Read one, shut the book, read something else, come back later. Stories can wait. I've always loved that. I mean, she's not saying it, but I'm reading in those sentences that, you know, that there are things you shut the book and you think about, but maybe you don't babble about.
Yes.
And yet, our show, this is what we do.
Mavis Gallant is the author of The Ice Wagon Going Down the Street. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.